At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One of the great unanswered questions of this financial crisis has been, how big is too big to fail? Thanks to a bank called CIT, we now know the answer. Big is a whole lot smaller than it used to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 15th of July. Good to have you here. We started off this week worrying about CIT. It's one of the country's biggest lenders to small and medium-sized businesses. As of Monday morning, it was holding on by a thread. There was a talk of a run on the bank amid serious liquidity problems. 2 days later, things have not gotten any better. There were meetings all day in Washington today trying to figure out what to do about it. Policymakers from the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department, and the FDIC are probably thinking back to last fall in Lehman Brothers as they find themselves asking once again whether a company is too big to fail. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
The cries for help sound familiar. Trade groups and analysts who cover CIT say a failure would be devastating for the economy. But Edward Altman, a finance professor at NYU's Stern School of Business, doesn't agree. He says a CIT failure would be a far cry from the meltdown the nation's biggest banks experienced last fall.
This is not, in my opinion, a systemic risk issue, and I don't think they should be bailed out. But that doesn't mean that they won't be.
Altman says the bar has been lowered for too big to fail. The new standard appears to be big enough to be annoying. And he says CIT is nothing like Lehman Brothers, the one bank that the government did allow to collapse, a decision many now regret.
I don't see how this company is going to be saved in the long run, which was not the case for Lehman. Lehman just had just too much debt and not enough friends out there, whereas CIT has a business model problem, which Lehman did not.
I think there's a lot of political pressure to finally not rescue one, but this would be a difficult first case.
That's Karen Petru, Managing Director of Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. She says a bailout of CIT would mean the government is doubling down on a bet it made months ago.
CIT has $2 billion in TARP money out, and if it failed to pay that back, that cost would come from the taxpayers.
But so would any additional money. And with many more small businesses expected to fail this year, CIT's still in trouble. More than $7 billion of the company's debt comes due next year. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
If there's one thing we've learned from Wall Street the past 2 years, it's that not everything is as it seems. For instance, just because somebody says something's a good investment doesn't always mean it is. The country's biggest public pension fund learned that the hard way. The California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS it's called, made investments based on AAA ratings from the big credit rating agencies. It ultimately lost up to $1 billion on some of those investments. And today, CalPERS sued the agencies for what it calls negligent misrepresentations. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that the defense will probably be that the raters have a First Amendment right to their opinions.
This isn't the first lawsuit stemming from the financial meltdown, and the ratings agencies have consistently argued they offer only their opinions, not investment advice. They claim they're covered under free speech protections. Joseph Mason is a banking professor at Louisiana State University. He says that argument might apply if CalPERS and other pension funds were free to disregard these ratings as if they were an editorial opinion.
This is not a free market. By regulation, CalPERS can only purchase investments that are rated triple B or better. But the government regulations that require that don't define what triple B means or what triple A means for that matter.
Mason says the agencies issue long disclaimers that say they're under no obligation to conduct investigations of any depth.
It's kind of like the government saying you have to buy this particular newspaper and abide by their opinions, but the newspaper has no responsibility whatsoever to report anything near the truth.
Still, management consultant and market commentator Peter Cohen says CalPERS itself isn't blameless.
CalPERS, which presumably has professional investment analysts deciding where to put the money, apparently chose not to care what they were investing in. Instead, what they decided to do was, oh, this is AAA rated, no problem, we'll buy it. They put $1.6 billion into it in 2006, and by 2008, the money was gone.
Because the ratings agencies are paid by the very companies they rate, they've also been accused of a conflict of interest. But the Obama administration's recent regulatory overhaul recommendations didn't suggest any major changes in the ratings process. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A lot of companies have been pulling back during this recession, cutting costs, laying off workers. But 7-Eleven, the convenience store, is going full speed the other way, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Ken Barnes is a real estate manager for 7-Eleven. He spent all day today driving around Manhattan, scouting new locations.
We really are taking a look at pedestrian traffic in front of the location, especially if we're in an area like the Financial District. You know, that's a key element for a store for us.
7-Eleven plans to open up to 250 more stores nationwide this year. That's 50% more than it opened in 2008. Barnes says the reason for this rapid expansion is simple. Retail rents are down by as much as 30%.
The mom-and-pop tenant that yesteryear we would have competed against is on pretty shaky ground, and landlords appreciate what we bring to the table as a credit tenant more today than they did a year ago.
For many people, 7-Eleven is a cheap alternative to restaurants and supermarkets. Its 5,700 stores have done well during the downturn. Some analysts call the chain recession-proof. Bert Flickinger is with the consulting firm Strategic Research Group. He says 7-Eleven is now positioning itself for the economy to rebound.
These are some of the best real estate prices in nearly 35 years. 7-Eleven knows it can expand, get low rents today, and have much more profitable stores tomorrow.
Flickinger says convenience stores are all about location. The average 7-Eleven might pull in $1 to $2 million a year. Find the right street corner, and that revenue can triple. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Why, yes, funny you ask. That was the Dow Jones Industrial Average you saw going through the roof today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama took to the bully pulpit today. He gave Congress a pat on the back for the work it's done so far on health care. And then he pushed lawmakers to hustle and get a final bill done before the August recess. Whatever it does wind up looking like, health care reform will come at a high initial cost. The plan the House released yesterday tops $1 trillion. To help pay for comprehensive coverage, House Democrats want to raise taxes on the wealthy. Commentator Robert Reich says that's a small price for the rich to pay.
It's the most blatant form of Robin Hood economics ever proposed. The House of Representatives' Universal Health Care Bill, announced yesterday, pays for the health insurance of the poorest 20% of Americans who need help affording it, with a tax surcharge on the richest 1%. I don't remember a redistribution this direct ever coming out of Congress. I mean, occasionally Congress closes a few tax loopholes at the top and offers a refundable tax credit to people near the bottom, or creates a poor people's program like Medicaid, paid for out of general revenues from a progressive income tax. But to say out loud that those in our society who can most readily afford it should pay for health insurance of those who cannot is, well, audacious. There's another word for it, fair. According to the most recent data, the richest 1% of American households now take home about 20% of total income, the highest percentage since 1928. Now, yes, I know, critics will charge that these are the very people who invest, innovate, and hire, and thereby keep the economy going. So raising their taxes will burden the economy and thereby hurt everyone, including those who are supposed to be helped. But there's no reason to suppose that taking a tiny sliver of the incomes of the top 1% will reduce all that much of their ardor to invest, innovate, and hire in the future. Yet if this tiny sliver means affordable health care for a far larger number of Americans, they will be able to get regular checkups and thereby stay healthy and productive. And a more healthy and productive workforce will do far more to build the American economy. One other virtue of this funding mechanism is its simplicity. A surcharge is simple to administer. And the whole idea is easily understood. Tax the very wealthy to keep everyone healthy. Not even a bad bumper sticker.
Robert Reich is professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Part-time slogan meister, too, I think. Send us your thoughts. Online is best. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Four years ago, Walmart decided it was going to go green, and whatever progress the world's biggest retailer may have made in reducing its environmental footprint, it is still the world's biggest retailer, which is to say it's still got a really big environmental footprint. Tomorrow, the company is going to announce its latest sustainability initiative. This one won't be cutting down on energy use or reducing packaging waste. It's Walmart's entire global supply chain, measuring the environmental and social costs of every product that hits its shelves. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Over the last few years, Walmart's attempt to create environmentally friendly stores has saved the company money while boosting its image as an eco-conscious retailer. But University of Arkansas sustainability professor John Johnson says the environmental benefits of those efforts are small for this reason.
Best estimates are about 90% of their environmental footprint resides outside of the company's boundaries in the supply chain.
That's why Walmart now wants its 60,000 suppliers to provide details on everything from the energy they consume to how the natural resources in their products are extracted. That information, along with how the items are used and disposed of, will be summarized on new product labels, something Andrew Hudson of the Environmental Defense Fund calls a game changer.
It's a shift in the way that we define consumerism. You know, it's no longer just about the product, you know, what it does and how much it costs. But it's pretty much now about the whole system of global commerce that goes into each product.
How Walmart determines whether its products are sustainable is another issue. Tyson Slocum with the consumer watchdog group Public Citizen says the potential for greenwashing is huge.
I'm not sure that it's appropriate for a giant retailer like Walmart to be crafting these definitions. I think we got to have an unbiased source.
Like the federal government, but Andrew Hudson at Environmental Defense says Walmart's inclusion of universities, manufacturers, and competing retailers in the process gives the initiative credibility. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Energy Secretary Stephen Chu is in Beijing, China today. He's there for talks on energy policy. That's a subject that usually brings with it talk of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, and Chu did say that China needs to do more to help control global warming. U.S. officials also want China to remove trade barriers that protect its domestic green energy industry from overseas competition, and eventually it wants China to offer the same opportunities the U.S. extends to foreign renewable firms that come here. Opportunities that are being taken, as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
On the high plains of northern Colorado, the world's biggest maker of wind turbines, the Danish company Vestas, has built its first U.S. manufacturing plant, and it's hiring hundreds of locals.
This is a blade factory. Right now, we're currently running 3 lines. When we're done with construction, we'll be running 6 lines.
That's Kevin Corey. He holds the vaguely European-sounding title of Director of People and Culture. Vestas accounts for 13% of all wind turbine sales in the U.S. Now it's aiming for more. Corey and another Vestas exec, Roby Roberts, give me a tour of the plant. It's on the outskirts of a small town called Windsor. This plant is so big, workers ride bikes to get from one end to the other.
Until you see it, it's really hard to fathom, because the scale of these blades, 120 feet that weigh nine tons?
These weigh seven.
See them down here, they seem so large, but when they're up on the tower, moving in the wind, they're enormous sails.
Vestas is moving stateside because it's following the money. Analysts predict explosive growth in the U.S. wind and solar power markets over the next decade. Dozens of states are requiring more electricity from renewable sources. A federal mandate is possible as well. And the Stimulus Act contains billions of dollars in tax incentives for clean energy. William Ambrose is president of Emerging Energy Research.
The current policy environment is much more stable than it has ever been in the past. And so it's attracting enormous interest from foreign players at this point.
Vestas's Roberts says in order to effectively compete in this growth market, his company needs to be closer to the customers.
These machines are getting bigger and bigger and increasingly more expensive to move around. And that can be up to 20% of the upfront costs. So we are absolutely convinced that building close to market makes a whole lot of sense.
Vestas isn't the only one who's concluded that. Germany's Siemens, Japan's Mitsubishi, and Spain's Gamesa are all opening wind turbine plants in the United States, and they're all going up against General Electric. GE has dominated the U.S. wind market for years, but its foreign rivals are getting a warm welcome from American cities desperate for new jobs. Again, Kevin Corey.
Most of the workers currently for us here in Windsor came out of the construction industry because we were in a big boom here, and then it shut off right away.
Colorado has given Vestas tax breaks and other incentives worth more than $1 million. In turn, the Danish company is spending over $1 billion on the Windsor plant and three others in the state. But it's not just foreign wind turbine makers. China-based SunTech, the world's largest solar panel company, is planning an American factory next year. Executives boast it's bringing jobs to America rather than taking them away. SunTech America Managing Director Roger Eford.
There's another reason that this needs to be done. And that's Buy American. There are Buy American requirements in a lot of the billions of dollars of stimulus monies that are going to go to green technologies.
Still, that doesn't mean the American market is falling into the laps of these foreign companies. At the Vestas factory in Windsor, they're making blades for wind turbines ordered before the recession hit. New business has nearly ground to a halt. But executives here believe federal stimulus funds will help recharge the wind business by next year. 30-year-old production worker Jerry Luckton sure hopes they're right.
In my interview, I was looking for something with longevity until I retire, and so far it looks like it's the place for me.
Vestas says by next year, it will employ over 700 local workers at the plant. In Windsor, Colorado, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, we say vulture investor. They say...
I think maybe a more useful moniker is a scrap processor.
All right. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shot up 3% today, 265 points, closed at 8,616. The NASDAQ packed on 3.5%, 63 points, ended at 1,862. The S&P 500 added 2.9%, 26 points, finished the session at 932. Signs that credit card defaults might be easing sent financial stocks to the bank. American Express and Capital One both charged up more than 11%. Discover found gains of more than 6%. Bank of America deposited nearly 4% today. And stop the presses, but Gannett, the giant media company, inked a 29% gain after posting a quarterly profit. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.61%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at Elance.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses how to prevent home foreclosures. The House Committee on Agriculture holds a hearing to review current issues in food safety. And some entertainment news. Nominations for the 61st Primetime Emmy Awards are announced in Los Angeles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
That music can only mean one thing. Time for your comments about our coverage. First up this week, Michelle Brown from Menlo Park, California. She pointed out, as did many of you, that our history of the GI Bill and how it helped a lot of Americans move up into the middle class only told half the story.
Whole swaths of the population, particularly black servicemen returning from the war, were denied those services due to unjust banking and realtor practices. This means that their descendants do not benefit from the accrued wealth that your guest described.
Commentator Justin Wolfers did not so much describe as argue last week that we really do need another economic stimulus package. Justin laid out his logic. Robert Wells of Cupertino, California, lays out his.
When I heard Justin Wolfers argue that we need another stimulus, I was reminded of the quote, "The beatings will continue until morale improves." Honest, confidence-building leadership would produce better results than the discredited placebo of stimulus.
Sears is looking for a little stimulus to its sales, so as we pointed out, it's selling some Christmas merchandise now. Marlene Athey of Rockland, Maryland, says she's still out looking for summertime stuff.
I decided to replace my tatty old sunshade over my table on the deck, much to the mirth of the employees at my local Home Depot, who wondered why I would be looking for such a thing now. All their stock had been sold. Christmas in July, indeed. I'll buy my new umbrella in December next time.
We did a different kind of retail story last week about a different kind of retail walk-in health insurance stores. Florida Blue, a store operated by Blue Cross Blue Shield, where customers can get help buying health coverage. One critic we quoted in our story said the stores won't do anything to make insurance easier to afford, but we didn't ask Blue Cross about that, and we should have. Mark Wright is with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Florida.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Florida created the Florida Blue Stores to assist people in making affordable health care choices. The stores are intended to provide personal service primarily to individuals and small group customers to either find a plan that will help fill their needs or help current customers with their service issues.
Some of you took issue with our story on movie tax credits. We told you about how the credits Massachusetts gives film companies weren't really paying off. But there were some complaints that we didn't put enough emphasis on the amount of indirect business movies bring with them. Joe Maiella is president of the Massachusetts Production Coalition.
There's no other sector of the Massachusetts economy that is performing as robustly as film production. Income generated from motion picture making in Massachusetts has increased from $6 million to $676 million through 2008.
If you want to clarify something you heard or correct it, drop us a line. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. So let's take a minute this afternoon to consider where we are. The stock market is on an upswing. Banks are back to raking in cash. Car companies are on the mend, at least. A recipe for the happy music, if ever there was one. Not, though, according to Dun and Bradstreet. The research firm is predicting a 60% increase in corporate bankruptcies here and in Europe over the rest of the year. That number makes most of us cringe, but it makes a certain class of investors rub their hands together. They are called distressed investors, or less kindly, vultures. Mark Sorensen works for CarVal Investors. Mark, good to talk to you.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
First things first, I would guess that vulture investor is probably not your preferred term of art.
You are correct. I think maybe a more useful moniker is a scrap processor. I realize that's not a very sexy sounding title, but you know, the kinds of things we look at in the distressed debt world, you know, are loans and bonds that, you know, your typical mutual fund buyer of high yield debt no longer has a use for. And they take it to the distressed marketplace to get rid of it, much like you would take a beaten up washing machine to the scrapyard.
All right, so let's break that down a little bit. Distressed debt, so that is what?
Distressed debt typically are loans and bonds that are in some sort of distress and need to be restructured, often in default. Right now, you have a lot of perfectly healthy or companies that are performing well that are trading at distressed prices. So one way to measure distressed debt is they look at loans that are trading below 80 cents on the dollar and bonds that are trading below 60 cents on the dollar and total that up. So at the end of December of last year, that totaled just over $1 trillion. The previous high was in 2001 when that amount hit $158 billion. So these are unprecedented times.
And when you say things like 80 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the dollar, that means that you're not paying face value for something. You are buying at less than face price.
That's exactly right.
What are you buying, though? As you go through that scrapyard and you go looking for distressed debt to buy, what are you buying? Are you buying those mortgage-backed securities we've been hearing so much about? Are you buying bonds from companies that have gone under? What exactly is it?
What I'm really talking about are corporate bankruptcies. An example would be a local company here, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which was purchased in 2007, and part of that purchase was financed by a $340 million loan. And the challenge right now is to figure out, okay, given what the economy looks like today, how profitable are they going to be and how much debt can that company carry going forward? And that's really what we're trying to figure out.
And I'm sure you guys are smart and all, but it seems to me that the risk that you take as you buy some of these assets could be substantial.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, the risk has never been greater. One way to think about that risk is, okay, I'm buying a discounted piece of distressed debt. What if I get it wrong? How low can that go? You can lose a lot of money, certainly, based on where things were returning historically.
So in real life, vultures, of course, pick over the bones of dead animals and help the whole ecosystem recover. Would it be fair to say that in some measure is what you guys are doing, or are you just out to make a buck?
That's not exactly how I would put it. I think if you think about distressed debt, there are really, sort of two paths a company can go down. You can be liquidated, or you can be restructured. A liquidation, I guess, something we're all familiar with, I think, is Circuit City. There just wasn't room for another, big box consumer electronic retailer, and it was liquidated. That's not often the best outcome for creditors and for other stakeholders like equity holders. Instead, you can, think of distressed debt buyers as buying things at a discount and looking to turn a balance sheet, turn a company's debt obligations into a small enough size they can manage it, that they can pay it off in the future, and emerge through the restructuring process as a healthy company that can be a useful company again.
And we have to say, make you guys some money.
Hopefully.
Mark Sorensen with Carval Investors in Minnesota. Thanks very much, Mark.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Help Wanted department. Best Buy has been in search of a senior manager for emerging media marketing. And most of the job requirements are pretty basic. A bachelor's degree, 2 years in mobile or social media marketing, Facebook, cell phones, that kind of thing. A year of blogging. Oh, and 250 followers on Twitter. Perhaps not surprising from a company where the CEO, Brian Dunn, is known to tweet himself. I just checked. I've got like 369. So, who knows? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 3%, 265 points. The Nasdaq jumped 3.5%, 63 points. The S&P 500 added 2.9%, 26 points. Bahan Belladouni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, a lot of people, like myself, run for fun or to stay fit, but not this Kenyan marathon.
It's something difficult. You have to work for it. Running a marathon is not running for fun. You have to be running for money.
Another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.